My name is Julie Yuwen Chen, Professor of Chinese Studies at University of Helsinki, Finland. Join me today to talk about China's evolving energy security strategy is Dr. Monique Taylor, Senior Lecturer in World Politics at the University of Helsinki. Monique has previously held the positions of Postdoctoral Fellow at Nanyang Technological University in Singapore, Research Fellow at National University of Singapore, and Lecturer at the University of Queensland. In 2014, Monique published a book entitled The Chinese State, Oil and Energy Security. In this book, she analyzed the policy rationale and institutional underpinnings of China's state-led or neo-mercantilist oil strategy and its development. Well, nearly 7 years have passed since Monique published her book. In today's Nordic Asia podcast, Monique will share with us how China's energy security strategy has evolved. Monique, thank you very much for being with us today. Let us begin with some basic facts. So China became a net oil importer in 1993. How was the situation before 1993?
Thank you for that introduction, Julie. It's a pleasure to be here. So regarding this question, prior to 1993, China had enjoyed around 30 years of oil self-sufficiency. This self-sufficiency was achieved in 1963 when the giant Daqing oil field in the country's northeast reached full production. So up until 1963, China had been a prime importer of Soviet oil, and it was the Sino-Soviet split beginning in 1959 that encouraged China's drive towards oil self-sufficiency. Daqing then became the symbol of self-reliance, national strength, and Chinese-led industrialization during the Maoist period. Self-reliance being a particularly important aspect of Chinese political culture during this time, and which has been revived recently by President Xi Jinping in the context of the US-China trade war. So it's a principle that continues to guide energy security. It's very much reflected in government control over the domestic oil industry and this state-led approach to securing oil assets abroad. So the shift to oil import dependency in 1993 was an unwelcome one for China's leaders. Since then, the gap between domestic oil production and consumption has increased rapidly, and today China's import dependency is high at just over 70%. This is despite the fact that China is the sixth largest oil producer in the world, ahead of big producers such as the United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, Iran, and Brazil. So the sheer scale of domestic oil demand in China cannot keep up with its domestic oil production. And so this ever-increasing gap between the two needs to be filled with imported oil. Again, energy security dilemma for China, which boils down to the maintenance of reliable and affordable oil supply. So China surpassed the US to become the world's largest importer in 2017, and it currently imports oil from around 50 countries at the rate of more than 10 million barrels per day. And in the wider context of its energy consumption, oil accounts for 20% of total demand. So this is a share that's currently on an upward trajectory, but it's expected to plateau in the 2030s and then gradually decline.
This leads us to the second question that I have is regarding the energy security strategy. What are the main elements of China's energy security strategy?
Okay, well, as you indicated at the start of this talk, China's energy security strategy is broadly neo-mercantilist. So neo-mercantilist oil policies are state-led, and they entail a zero-sum approach to competition over oil supply. While China purchases the bulk of its oil supplies from the open market, it's unwilling to leave oil security purely to market forces to determine the outcome, and so it pursues these other approaches at the same time. Over the past 15 to 20 years, China's policy approaches in this realm have certainly not been static. They've evolved and adapted to changing circumstances, but they still sort of fall under this overarching state-led framework. So the main elements of China's energy security strategy include increasing domestic oil production as much as possible, acquiring overseas oil assets and equity oil production, diversifying oil suppliers and transportation routes, and also methods of transportation, building and expanding government-controlled strategic petroleum reserves, engaging in economic statecraft and oil diplomacy with oil-producing countries, and also naval modernization. So taken together, these various oil policy approaches amount to a neo-mercantilist energy security strategy. So in essence, it's a hedging strategy against risks to supply disruption. So I'll elaborate on just a couple of these policy approaches to give a more detailed picture of China's strategy. The approach of overseas oil asset acquisitions has received the most public interest and attention in the past. So from China's perspective, the rationale behind owning and controlling foreign oil in the ground is that it could be directed to China in the event of conflict leading to disruption in its oil supply. However, this is an untested theory, and what we've seen to date is that most of China's equity oil is sold on the open market. From around the mid-2000s, China's national oil companies, Sinopec, the China National Offshore Oil Corporation, and China National Petroleum Corporation embarked on a global buying spree of oil assets. And this accelerated in the post-global financial crisis years from 2009 to 2013. So from 2005 to 2015, and primarily between 2009 and 2013, a total of $134 billion was spent on overseas asset acquisitions by China's national oil companies. It's important to remember that the global energy security landscape at this time looked a bit different to now, or at least up until recently, as crude oil prices were soaring and peaked at $150 per barrel in 2008. And the situation was one of relative oil scarcity. So this was not the case from 2015 onwards when oil prices collapsed. So many of the figures that China's oil companies paid for foreign oil companies with assets in locations throughout Africa, Central Asia, and Latin America were considered astonishing. For example, in 2009, Sinopec acquired the Swiss-Canadian company Adax Petroleum, whose oil assets are primarily located in Gabon, Nigeria, Cameroon, and the Kurdistan region of Iraq. And it paid $7.24 billion for this company. This was the largest ever foreign acquisition by a Chinese company at that time. And it was considered a pretty staggering sum to pay for a relatively small independent oil company. So this and other acquisitions led some observers to form the view that Chinese oil companies were overpaying for these oil assets. And a recent study found that China's national oil companies paid on average 64% more than what an international oil company would have paid for the same assets in that post-global financial crisis period. In the case of the Adax acquisition, it was estimated that Sinopec paid five times what an international oil company would have paid. So there are several, yes, there are several possible reasons as to why the national oil companies paid such a premium for foreign oil assets, including lack of experience, the additional energy security and political imperatives that motivate their behaviour, and that during this period of high oil prices, perceived oil scarcity gave rise to a scramble to secure oil supplies, and as a result, mistakes were made. This approach has been scaled back in recent years for a number of reasons, and there has been more of a shift to increasing China's presence in global oil markets and for China's national oil companies to get the best price for oil. So China's oil companies have become more risk conscious and are now less inclined to continue the buying spree approach, having made some bad decisions previously. Also, the US shale oil revolution precipitated a collapse in oil prices in 2015 and a shift towards oil abundance. So this served to alleviate China's energy security anxieties to some extent, and it led it to focus on purchasing cheap oil from the open market, particularly to fill its strategic petroleum reserves, which now covers more than 100 days of oil imports. China, as I said, is also very interested in diversifying its oil suppliers. But another significant element is the diversification of both transportation routes and methods of transportation to enhance energy security. So currently around 90% of China's oil imports arrive by sea, with most of them passing through the Straits of Malacca. China wishes to reduce its heavy reliance on this strategic choke point due to concerns that its oil imports could be cut off by a naval blockade, for instance, imposed by the US and its allies in the event of a military conflict in the South China Sea or over Taiwan. So China is pursuing oil pipeline construction, notably from places like Kazakhstan and Myanmar. And a pipeline has also been proposed for Pakistan that would transport oil across the Himalayas, despite the daunting engineering challenges and extraordinary cost. So the high dependency of oil imports arriving by sea and reliance on free passage through the Straits of Malacca has been a key rationale for naval modernization efforts as well, obviously motivated by in a much broader way than energy security, but that's definitely part of it.
I remember you talk about the Chinese government's control. I think this leads me to ask my third question, which is the relationship between the oil company, China's oil company, and the Chinese state.
Yes, so this relationship between the Chinese central government and the national oil companies has been the focus of a lot of attention in the past in both scholarly and policy communities. So there are diverging views that tend to emanate from different bodies of literature. The international relations literature tends to view the Chinese state as strong, monolithic, and unitary. It's sometimes called the China Inc. view. This is probably because many IR academics are focused on power and geopolitics and so fail to pay enough attention to the domestic governance landscape and how it influences China's foreign relations and international economic behaviour. So according to this perspective, China's national oil companies function as arms of the state that seamlessly implement Beijing's energy policies and directives. The China studies literature, on the other hand, offers an entirely different view. So scholars from this discipline tend to view the Chinese state as weak, fragmented, and decentralised, and they typically focus on areas of bureaucratic dysfunction. When it comes to energy security, scholars who adhere to this perspective emphasize the administrative decentralization and fragmentation that has occurred during the early stage of the reform era, beginning in 1978. So according to this perspective, China's oil companies are fairly independent and commercially oriented and are not beholden to Beijing in any major way. In fact, some experts go as far as to say that we see the tail wagging the dog, as these national oil companies are so powerful that they call the shots and shape energy policy direction. So in my book, I argued that while both views shed light on important aspects of the Chinese state, they are one-sided in their analysis and they overstate their respective cases, hence failing to capture the complexity of the relationship between the central government and the national oil companies. I advanced the concept of collaboration governed by hierarchy to describe the relationship, as it captures the realities of both top-down authority and fragmentation within the Chinese political system. So here the flow of authority between the governments and the national oil companies goes both ways. And since these oil companies understand the oil industry better than China's leaders do, they are very compelling policy advisors and initiators. However, ultimate top-down authority rests with the central government. It retains powerful levers and mechanisms of control through ownership, financing, personnel appointments and remuneration, approvals for mergers and acquisitions, and asset sales. So this top-down flow of authority has been strengthened and further centralised under President Xi Jinping via his anti-corruption campaign. So Xi broke up what was perceived to be a powerful petroleum faction consisting of oil company executives. So this resulted in the resignation of the oil sector's former patron, Zhu Yongkang, along with top oil company executives as they were investigated for and charged with corruption. Many of the national oil companies' overseas acquisitions came under scrutiny as well during this time, particularly the underperforming ones. So, for example, Sinopec invested $10 billion US dollars in Angola between 2008 and 2015, and this investment failed to generate any commercial returns for the company. So it led to the arrest of Sinopec's former president, Zhu Xulin, in 2015 for bribery in the securing of contracts in Angola. Hence, China's national oil companies have been much more hesitant to go out and spend extravagantly in the manner in which they did before. And frankly, there hasn't been a need to since oil prices collapsed in the mid-2010s and there was abundant oil supply. Under these conditions, there was no compelling need to go out and lock in oil supply.
Yeah, so collaboration governed by hierarchy. So that's the relationship between the Chinese oil company and the state. Now I'm thinking about the Belt and Road Initiative, which was kicked off in 2013 and you know has gotten a lot of international attention. And if my understanding is correct, I think the Chinese oil diplomacy also falls under the BRI banner. Can you tell us a bit about this development?
Yes, so it appears to be the case. I haven't done extensive research on this since sort of the mid-2010s, but from what I can gather, there has been a shift there. So prior to the launch of the Belt and Road Initiative in 2013, oil diplomacy was used by Beijing, particularly towards the African continent, to support the activities of China's national oil companies. However, since 2013, oil diplomacy has become a less prominent strategy as China's overseas oil activities fall under the BRI. So political support for these Chinese companies abroad now occurs more within this framework. The support that the oil companies receive is under a broader framework rather than being specific to oil, which I think makes a difference as well. And furthermore, given that oil security is no longer the most urgent policy priority, state funding for the purchase of foreign oil assets is not as generous as before. But at the same time, China's overall approach to the acquisition of overseas oil resources is arguably more coordinated and integrated through the BRI. There has also been greater integration of China's energy strategy into the BRI using resource-backed loans or oil-backed loans, as they are being used to finance infrastructure projects. So this actually affords less risk and more flexibility and options for China. In addition, the loans used to fund a wide range of infrastructure development into which Chinese technology, skills, and labor are sourced, provide further economic uplift and other benefits for China. So I think that's another thing to emphasize is a shift away from purchasing foreign oil fields and companies towards these oil-backed loans.
Interesting. I think my next question is also related to another major change, and that is the COVID pandemic. So how has the pandemic affected the general oil industry in the world and then China's oil industry specifically?
Yes, so the pandemic has had some temporary impacts on the global oil industry. We are also seeing the effects of other longer term and more profound trends kick in to produce an altered landscape. So in 2020, global oil demand declined sharply owing to the pandemic, and this caused a collapse in oil price. In 2021, oil prices have rebounded to their highest level since 2014, reaching just over $85 per barrel in October. So this is due to the strong rebound in consumption, but some of it is also due to fuel switching to diesel and fuel oil for power due to the coal and gas shortages in China, India, and Europe. So in addition to the rebound in consumption, we have tightening supply due to years of underinvestment in new supply following the oil price collapse of 2015 and in the context of energy transition away from fossil fuels. So this may lead China to recalibrate its strategy again under conditions of higher oil prices and more scarce supply.
Thank you very much, Monique, for sharing your insight with us. You have been listening to Helsinki China podcast with me, Julie Yuwen Chen. Talk to you next time.